Kildare Today with Clem Ryan.
With Whitewater Shopping Centre Newbridge, Ireland's largest regional shopping centre. Fashion, food, film, all under one roof in the heart of Newbridge. WhitewaterSC.ie.
Right, before we have a little bit of music, I'll catch up on your messages first. And Clem, regarding all the Dubs moving into the county, let them in. We might have a chance of winning Sam Maguire. Well, I suppose it's an ill wind that doesn't blow some good anyway. And wishing Leslie Williams a happy birthday. 55 today, we're told. It comes in from all his family and friends and from Neville Hendy. And play a nice song for him. Well, I think I have a nice song coming up next. Those 450,000 semi-D houses are subsidised by government grants up to 90,000, says a listener. These houses are mostly timber frames, so cheaper and faster to build than bricks. So the developers are making more profits on the subsidies paid by the government for first-time buyers, who are then locked into longer-term mortgages with the bankers. Business as usual in Ireland, says a listener. Hi Clem, all we're doing here is playing into the hands of the government and the banks, says Matt. They'll know every penny you have and where you're spending it. Cash is still legal tender. We'll regret the day it's gone. Rant over, says Matt. I don't know. I actually, to be honest with you, practically unknown to myself. If you asked me now for a loan of a few bob, cash, I wouldn't be able to give it to you. Don't carry cash anymore. Because the whole idea of the cards, it's just so easy, you know, tap and go. And even I have my card on my phone as well. So even if I forgot my card or my wallet, all I have to do is open up my phone, tap it, and hey, we paid. And the great thing about that as well, I think in regards to the cashless society, even though I'm an owl fella, as I'm reminded here on the programme by Cuiva and listeners, is that it's great for keeping a record of what you've spent. Because every time you tap, remember, you're going to get a statement at some stage from your bank, and it'll tell you exactly about your spending pattern, and also whether you've been charged properly for something, and if you had a disagreement with a provider, an outlet, a shop, a store, a supermarket, at any stage about something you bought, if you had lost the receipt, if you have proof of payment on your phone or wherever. You know, I think the advantages are yes. And for those people who might be afraid of it, it's dead simple. If an owl fella like Clem can get on top of it, believe me, you can in regards to that. No mention of something 25 years ago today. What was 25 years ago? No. 25 years ago today. That Sam Kildare won the All... Or Kildare didn't win. They won the Leinster Final 1998. That would be 25 years ago, would it? No. Yeah, it would. 1998, Kildare played in the All-Ireland Final. So was the Leinster Final 25 years ago today? I imagine it was, because we didn't play All-Ireland Finals in July at that stage. Oh, boys. Happy memories, and thanks for the reminder on that. Clem, all we're doing is playing to... All right, had that match. And 25 years ago, when Glenn Ryan, what a warrior, the current manager, brought the Leinster Trophy. What's the name of the Leinster Trophy, by the way? Because it's just slipped me. Somebody, I'm sure, will tell me in regards to... And we had a great, great time touring the place. I remember myself and Pat Costello were emceeing off the stage in Naas. And later on, we went to Athy. It was a great day. I think we were in nearly every town touring the county. And then the All-Ireland semi-final. I recall I was working with CKR at that stage before KFM ever came on the scene. And we did the most marvellous programme from Sarsfield's clubhouse for the All-Ireland semi-final. Live links to Kerry, some of the greats of Kildare and Kerry football on the programme. And we had a marvellous party night over in Sarsfields. And of course, Kildare got to that final. And then, very, very unluckily, I think, I look back on that 98 final. And I think, you know, Michael Donlan did a lot of damage when he sold it up the field and that goal came about. But hard to believe, lads, that that's 25 years ago. And I remember getting a present of a clock with a photograph of the team. And I often look at that and say, where are they now? And thankfully, they're all still around and doing well. And three or four of them are still involved as on the Kildare management team. Glenn, Rainbow, Dermot Hairley, Was Johnny Dyle there in 98? I don't think he was. No, Johnny Dyle came later in regards to that. But memories are made of this. That's Train. That's the band, by the way. Drive By being the song. Now, yes, Clem, Kildare won the Leinster final. How do I remember? Well, we had just moved in from Lucan, County Dublin, says Maria Martin in Clane. Oh, ho, 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 Maria. Maria, you must be a Kildare person now. Have you got the Kildare accent? Or are you still at the touch of the old Dubs accent? Yeah, you have to hand it to the Dubs. Super team. And I have to say, I mentioned this to somebody on Sunday after watching the match. The one thing I love about these Dublin players, this Dublin team, no posers. You know, they don't go around boasting about it or anything else. They give excellent interviews, very genuine interviews. I saw James McCarthy, the other players, interviewed as well. Dean Rock was interviewed. And they're very down to earth for a county, you know, that's dominated the football scene. And I think they're an example to players everywhere about the way they comport themselves and behave themselves and whatever else. Yes, tough men on the field. But, you know, in fairness, the game, they play the game, basically, I would consider that Dublin team gifted players and players who play the game very, very fairly. And I know now I'm going to get texts in saying, oh, this fella did that and that fella did that. Everything happens with every team on the field. But I think that by and large, this is a team that's been exemplary in its playing performance over the years. Now, Maria Martin, how about that? An old endorsement of the Dubs from a half Clare man, half Kildare man in regards to that. The Delaney Cup, yes indeed. Those are the umpire flags I borrowed when the Leinster final was over. Oh, did you? Because that listener sent in a photo. I won't say who that listener in is who stole the umpire flags, but nice one. Well done in regards to that. Now, I'll catch up on some of your other messages in a minute because I want to go on to the tragedy that continues to unfold on our roads. And we've heard about it terribly in the last couple of days with the deaths of those two young women in the Monaghan on their way to their Debs, which should be one of the happiest occasions that they will ever undergo. And yet, at the end of the day, two young people aged 16 and 17 are dead. We saw a death on a road in Meath in the last couple of days, and it just seems that we hardly open our papers any day and we have reports of deaths. The Road Safety Authority has issued a stark warning that years of road safety progress is at risk of being undone. New figures revealing that road deaths in the first half of this year are the worst for 6 years, with 100 people killed on Ireland's roads so far this year. That's 100 people now, up to the end of June. It does not count at least a half a dozen who have died on our roads, and possibly more during the month of July as well. The RSA is warning that should the current trends continue, as many as 168 lives will be lost on our roads by the end of the year. To reflect more on this, I'm joined by the founder of the Park Road Safety Group, Susan Gray. Susan, welcome back to the programme, and it's great to talk to you again, but unfortunately, each time we have this discussion, it's about more deaths on our roads.
Right, good morning, Clem. Yeah, it's a dreadful year so far. 100 deaths to date, and 17 of them alone was in July, Clem. Mm-hmm. In July last year, we had 12.
12?
So, yeah, 12.
And that's 12 too many.
12 too many.
You found now, it, just to, by way of context for listeners, Susan, Park Road Safety Group. Tell them what that's about and why you founded it.
I founded it a year after my husband was knocked down and killed by a learner driver on St. Stephen's Night, 2004. Steve, my husband, was a Hackney driver, and he was on his last run of the night, leaving people home from the local nightclub in Ashon and Donegal, when a young 21-year-old learner driver, Michael McColgan, on a long straight part of the road, Steve, my husband, was out of his vehicle, saying to two of his passengers, when this young lad came along and knocked him down, and Steve's body ended up in a field behind his Hackney van. And he died at the scene, he suffered horrific injuries. And I know them off by heart. So I asked at the time, that's a young fellow on St. Stephen's Night who had been socialising in pubs in a nightclub, if he had been tested for alcohol. And I was told no, that it was left to the discretion of the Gardaí. In the north, in Northern Ireland, it's mandatory to test all surviving drivers involved in fatal crashes. So,
and I think it's that way now. You started the group as a result of that tragedy.
5 years later, we got mandatory testing of all drivers involved in fatal crashes. But we noticed then, Clem, there was so many other things that needed to be tackled. So we continually attend the Doyle and take part and put in submissions for road traffic bills to make lives.
One wonders, Susan, you know, with the development of technology, safety in cars, better roads, everything else, the data continues to reveal that things are getting worse rather than better. 23 people aged between 16 and 25 lost their lives on the road so far this year. Well, I think we can add now the two more in County Monaghan, unfortunately, at 16 and 17 years of age. So that's 25 people whose lives have ended between ages 16 and 25, which is almost the same number as with the same period in 2021 and 2022 combined. It shows that almost half of all deaths on the roads occur at night when roads are quieter, which is a complete contraindicator. Three counties, Galway, Mayo and Cork, accounted for almost one third of all fatalities. Why do you think this is still happening and so stark?
Well, there's even more than that, because there was 13 and a 14-year-old killed as well. So the under 25s is much greater than the figure Doris A. gave. So,
and one other thing before you just reply to me. The point is made, for example, and was made by Chairperson Liz O'Donnell of the Road Safety Authority. She said, when a crash like this happens, it has an impact on hundreds of people. And, you know, and that is something that we often forget when we're talking about numbers of 100 people killed or whatever. Each one of those people, the ripple effect of that on families, as you know well, Susan, is so traumatic.
I spoke very well yesterday on that issue. And she's right. The ripple effect is immense. And the pain never goes away. You just change the way you live and you become a different person. Totally. Totally. Stephen recognised me now if he was here.
You have spent.
The RSA say they're going to concentrate on Mayo, Cork, and Galway. But we analysed the road test claim, and they would need to concentrate on Meath and West Meath too, two neighbouring counties. They're the next highest. Meath has 7 fatalities to date, and West Meath has 6. Now, Westmeath only had 3 deaths for the entirety of 2022, and Meath had 7 for the entire year. So they're going in the wrong direction, and their neighbouring counties, just the same as Galway and Mayo, who are the highest. These two next neighbouring counties, there's something happening there. So we'd like the RSA, when they're looking into this, to look into that as well.
And Susan, what do you think is missing in these figures not being reversed, that we're still getting the staggering amount? Is it as simplistic that there are tens of thousands more people on our roads than there used to be? So maybe that if we factor that in, the statistics mightn't be as damning as they seem to be on paper.
No. When you're out driving and you see the ones that you meet, there are so many. As Liz O'Donnell said, they're just speeding. There's so many speeding there, and so many on their mobile phones, holding their mobile phones, texting and taking calls. which is so, so dangerous. So I know Liz O'Donnell said they're going to concentrate on speeding and educating the young ones, seeing as there's so many young ones down. It's always, the majority has always been young ones. And she's going to fight for funding from Justice for more GoSafe cameras. That's all fine and well, we agree with that. But GoSafe cameras will never catch a drink or drug driver, will never catch somebody on their mobile phone. And they are things that are totally out there, up there, along with speeding. So they need to, we need more guards. There's nothing to beat the thought of coming across a checkpoint or a guard that's stopping you. Nothing. No speed camera will ever replace that. And no speed camera will ever catch somebody on their mobile phone. So they have to call and ensure that we have more members in our traffic course, road policing units, because the figures are going down, down, down. So it's not going in the right direction, and we think that's a contributory factor as well.
All right. So, Susan, I'm going to have to leave it there, but we just thought it necessary once again, unfortunately, to profile these figures, to try and appeal to everybody out there who is using our roads, whether you be vehicle users, motorcycle, cycles or pedestrians, that we all need to look out for each other. And common sense, and I've often used the expression on the programme, that in all this rushing about that we all do, including yours truly, I mean, no point throwing stones if you're living in glass houses, we all rush around. And isn't it better to arrive alive and late than dead early?
And expect the unexpected.
And expect.
I always think that, that's a great saying. Expect the unexpected.
Susan Gray, founder of Park Road Safety Group, thank you for your efforts in addressing this issue, Susan, and thank you for coming on the programme this morning.
Right. Thanks very much for asking me on, Clem.
And good morning. Bye. Founder Bye. Of the Park Road Safety Group, that's Susan Gray in regards to that. Now, let's go to another issue, because the National Drug Treatment Reporting System data on alcohol treatment for 2022 has been released. The report produced by the Health Research Board reveals that 7,421 cases were treated for problem alcohol treatment in 2022, with new cases accounting for 44.2% of the total. Let's hear more from Senior Researcher with the Health Research Board, Dr. Susie Lyons. Dr. Lyons, good morning.
Good morning, Clem.
Thank you for hanging on there on the phone while we were speaking with Susan, because I know you're under a very pressing schedule in regards to that. 7,421 cases, and half of those are new. Problem alcohol issues.
So that's right, Clem. So this week, the Health Research Board, we published our annual treatment figures, and it covers a seven-year period, 2016 to 2022. And in one way, it is good news that people are reaching out and being getting treatment. And in 2022, as I say, was almost 7,500 cases, which was up on previous years. But I suppose what is of concern is that the level of alcohol dependence among those seeking treatment is high. In fact, two in every three cases were already alcohol dependent by the time they sought treatment. And unfortunately, that just means that, you know, treatment is that little bit more difficult and the road to recovery that little bit harder.
The median age at which cases enter treatment, your research shows, is 42. Just dwell on that a little bit longer across the various age ranges.
So that's right. So on average, people are age 42 years or entering treatment. But what we do see is that, in fact, most people in treatment typically have started drinking at the age of 16. So half actually have started drinking before the age of 16. So that's when they're teenagers, and actually before the legal limit. And in fact, research shows the earlier you start drinking, the more likely you are to end up in treatment. But what it actually means is that people have been drinking for quite a number of years, 20 years or more, and probably harmfully before they eventually seek treatment. And as I said, unfortunately, the data shows that many are already alcohol dependent by the time they get to treatment. So what we really need to see is people reaching out and coming to treatment earlier, before they become alcohol dependent and before they start experiencing the worst harms.
Yeah, 44% new cases, as I say, 52% previously treated. The median age, 42. But there are also other aspects of this in regards to the numbers who are homeless and those who are employed or not employed who are coming for help, and the gender breakdown as well.
So that's right. We do see some differences between men and women accessing treatment. Women tend to be that little bit older. They also... They also tend to have better levels of education than men and slightly lower levels of homelessness. But otherwise, there are quite a lot of similarities between men and women. We do see very high levels of unemployment in both men and women. Well, with men, it's almost half, 50%. And this could be, for example... an indicator of the harms of alcohol use, because people who are one of the harms of alcohol use is that it affects their not only their health, their liver damage, their stomach, but also can affect them financially and socially. They may have been in trouble at work because they're hungover or haven't turned up, or they may have even lost their job. So the harms of problem alcohol use aren't just around that your health, but they have much wider consequences.
One of the striking things that emerges is that 6 in 10 cases, 60%, are consuming alcohol daily. And in particular, women seeking treatment for problem alcohol use are typically consuming 15 standard drinks every day. Whether anecdotal or otherwise, there seems to have been a prevalence of reports in recent years, Susie, in regards to this, that the old wine o'clock, to coin that awful phrase that's going about, of people, and particularly women at home, drinking more wine bought from supermarkets, etc. Is that a factor?
So, yeah, it's very clear. What we see in those cases who have been drinking, they are drinking more in one day than is recommended by the HSE low-risk guidelines for an entire week. So that Wow. is really, really significant. So for women, yeah, so the weekly low risk guidelines are 11 standard drinks, and that means a standard drink is a small glass of wine, a measure of spirits, or half a pint.
11 of those. And what about for men?
For men, it's 17, but that is over the week. So that so as again, a standard drink is a half a pint. Equates to half a pint or a small glass of wine or one pub's measure of spirits. So for men, we see that in a typical session, they're drinking 20 standard drinks, which equates to 10 pints. That's in one session in a day. So that is above the weekly low-risk recommended guidelines for men from the HSE, which is 17. So I know that's a lot of figures, but it is... Yeah, basically, people in treatment or cases of treatment are drinking far above than what is recommended.
Before I want to move on to polydrug use, but before I do, there's a statistic there that I was looking at in the last couple of seconds from your report, and it shows that of those seeking treatment, 68% were previously treated cases.
That's what we're seeing, is that unfortunately people are having to return to treatment, but that is part of a person's maybe individual journey. That you may need several episodes of treatment before you can start your road to recovery. But the most important thing is to reach out and look for help. And if you don't feel comfortable going with your GP, the HSE, for example, has a confidential helpline, or you can go online and look for help. And both the important thing is to reach out and seek help, because what we see in treatment is that many are already alcohol dependent,
yeah.
And so really it just makes treatment that bit more difficult. And so if they had sought treatment before that time, then perhaps they wouldn't have become alcohol dependent and wouldn't need to return to treatment again and again.
Yeah, there seems to be high a level of relapse. And finally, the area, it's not just alcohol, because you've also had a look at what's called polydrug problem, drug by age, cannabis, cocaine and so forth.
That's right. What we do see that one in four cases had problem use of additional drugs along with alcohol, and that was mainly cocaine, cannabis and benzodiazepines. And again, unfortunately, what this means is that if you're using alcohol and other drugs, it just makes your treatment that bit more complex, but also it increases a person's risk of other harms. For example, you're at more risk of an overdose if you're using more than one drug. And really then of concern is that we've really seen the increase in the number of people using alcohol and cocaine over the period. In 2016, for example, it was 3 in 10 polydrug users, and in 2022 it's gone up to 6 in 10. Now, the issue in particular around using alcohol and cocaine is really, yeah, it is concerning, because when you use alcohol and cocaine together, they combine in the body to produce another substance called cocoethylene. Now, cocoethylene is more toxic than alcohol or cocaine alone, and so has an even greater negative effect. So therefore, it increases the risk of all those negative side effects, increases the risk of overdose, of fatal overdose, of damage to the liver and heart, the risk of seizures or impulsive behavior. So again, a particular issue when using alcohol and cocaine together.
Indeed, I tell you, it makes riveting reading, folks, in terms of the numbers. The number of people treated for alcohol last year increasing by 8%. 7,421 cases, 44% of those are new cases. The average case age people begin drinking is 16, even though that's illegal, while the average age of those in treatment is 47, and almost half of the cases were unemployed, and many more stats in relation to that report by the Health Research Board. And Dr. Susie Lyons is a senior researcher compiling that report. And Dr. Lyons, thank you again for your time.
Thank you, Clem. Thank you.
Good morning.
Kildare Today with Clem Ryan.
With Whitewater Shopping Centre Newbridge, Ireland's largest regional shopping centre. Fashion, food, film, all under one roof in the heart of Newbridge. WhitewaterSC.ie.
Okay, just ahead of our next item, don't forget we've Crime Time on the way as well with Garda Sean O'Mahony. Clem, the credit card and Visa card is dangerous. If you keep tapping, you end up broke. I know it's an easy way to spend, all right, in regards to that. Clem, what happens to all the auto jumble car boot sales when we go cashless? It will do away with all of these things. Not necessarily, Brendan, born in Hackenstown in County Carlow, on that one. People, maybe these car boot sales will have to make sure that they're able to deal with debit cards and stuff like that. Clem, I watched a game on Sunday in an Irish bar in Menorca. 99.9% Dubs, 1% Kerry supporters, and after the final whistle, a Kerry supporter gave a Kerry flag to a Dublin supporter. That's sportsmanship at its best, says Breda. I'm not sure they might have wanted the flag though. Here it's mandatory now that all drivers that have any interaction with the Garda are tested for drink driving. I was once tested twice in 10 minutes because I passed through the same checkpoint twice in 10 minutes, and it's good to hear that going on given the numbers of deaths in on our roads. Jack says, lack of road policing, shortage of Gardaí, 4,000 early retired, 100 stations closed in the last 10 years and never replaced. The fault lies with the government. And another listener says, it's not only speeding that causes these tragedies. Most rural roads are in terrible condition and have little or no road markings. And finally, on our last item in regards to the Health Research Board's alcohol report, a listener says, alcohol shuts down the prefrontal cortex. This is the main decision maker of the brain, the CEO, if you like. When this shuts down, poor decision making takes place. I stopped drinking alcohol 3 years ago. Best decision I ever made, says that listener. Thank you for all your messages, and if any more, I'll catch up in a few minutes' time. The new president of the Association of Secondary Teachers in Ireland is Geraldine O'Brien. Good morning, Geraldine.
Good morning, Clem.
Thank you for joining us.
And thank you for having me.
From one Clare man to a Clare woman.
Okay.
Yeah. Now, you're a Kilkee woman. You're on the poor side of the county, whatever else, like, you know.
You said that now, Clem.
I'd be a magpie. Not the Dunbeg type now, but of the Clare Castle type, okay?
Okay.
Right. Now that we've established that, congratulations on your ascension to the top position in the Association of Secondary Teachers in the country. And research showing that 75% of schools did not receive a single application for an advertising teaching post in 2022-23 school year, while 81% of schools had to employ at least one unqualified teacher. Geraldine O'Brien, will you tell me why a job that has 6 months' holidays a year, employment for life, generous pensions, all sorts of sweeteners and everything else cannot attract teachers? Why?
Well, now, Clem, you must have been blinded by the sunshine in West Clare when you believed they have 6 months' holidays. But that aside, yes, a very good question, Clem. Why is teaching become unattractive? Well, in my opinion, teaching has become unattractive for a number of reasons. One, the housing difficulties, maybe not necessarily in West Clare, but the housing difficulties in urban and city areas, the cost of living, the teachers' workload, and the fact that schools are starved of essential resources. And then the length of the day, in particular for those who have small children, with, say, Croke Park hours, where they have to do extra hours in the evening and are paying a babysitter for a longer time. And to go back then to the initial part of your question, the inability to find qualified teachers. Like, and as you say, 81% of management said they had to employ at least one unqualified teacher. Now, if you have an unqualified teacher in a school and that reoccurs for a number of terms or a number of days, a number of months even, that means that a subject is dropping off the curriculum. So that's affecting the choice of subjects for students. Say, if they can't find a physics teacher, if they can't find a chemistry teacher, and those subjects are dropped from the curriculum, that's then impacting on students in their choices of what they want to study, if it's an avenue they wish and a career they wish to pursue in college. So it's detrimental to the student. It's causing burnout for the teacher who has to do it, because they're not in their chosen field. They're not teaching the subject they trained for in college. They studied in college. They're teaching another subject. That's causing pressure. That's causing burnout. And they are some of the factors that is fueling the teacher shortage.
No, I'm not discounting those difficulties, and that they're very, very real indeed, Geraldine. In another lifetime, I would have had experience of what you're talking about. But nevertheless, and it's not just teaching that's experiencing that shortage. Practically every sector of the economy is having difficulty recruiting people. I know here on the radio end of things that before you'd advertise for someone, for a news journalist or whatever else, you'd get 100 responses. Now you're lucky if you get one or two in regards to that, because many, many more young people are taking the option of the high road to Australia or the States or whatever. But that aside for the moment, that is quite a staggering statistic, that 75% of schools did not receive a single application for an advertised teaching's post in 2022-23. I would ask you, were the majority of those schools in Dublin, whereby it's been well chronicled at this stage that due to accommodation costs that people just don't want to work in the capital anymore or live there anyway, can't live there?
Well, while the survey, the results of the survey doesn't indicate clearly that it occurred more in Dublin and in the suburbia and we'll say in the region of the Pale and the bigger cities, I'd say 100% or 99% correct that we could presume that would be the situation, Clem, because my reason for saying that is if a teacher takes up a position in the city or in a major urban area, if after 6 months, and remember they might have a full-time contract, after 6 months they find a teaching position in a more rural area, they will move to that area purely because of the cost of living crisis, the cost of housing, the cost of renting in the city. So for that reason, I'm agreeing with you that the major cost of rent, the biggest rent cost is in the cities and urban areas.
All right. Now, we know the reasons then. You've articulated some of the reasons why people are not being attracted to teaching. I think there is the wider thing in society with the present generation that it's not just in the teaching area. It's in many areas of the economy where people cannot secure staff. And it seems to be nearly a post-pandemic thing. I asked one young person recently about, you know, the possibility of a job. And they said, no, I'm going to head off altogether. And that's not the first time I've come across that kind of thing. In regards to, we're on the verge of being back to school again, unbelievably, what happened to the summer months. And the government has initiated a scheme for free books for primary school students. That is not the case in secondary schools, where the issue of the extraordinary high costs for parents with people starting secondary school or going to secondary school generally range from the staggering cost of books, uniforms, and, of course, the old reliable in terms of so-called voluntary fees, Geraldine.
Well, to take your first point there, the book rental, Clem. In second-level schools, there is a book rental scheme operated by most schools. But it would be great, as you articulated there, to extend that to second-level schools. The cost of uniforms, they... Uniforms could be bought at a cheaper cost if it wasn't a requirement that the crest be on the jumper or on the hoodie. However, in my opinion, the school should buy the crest so that parents can go back to what our grandparents did, sew on the crest.
Yeah, I mean, this is absolutely nonsensical, the whole idea. I mean, I believe in school uniforms because it reduces and diminishes the division between well-off and those who are not well-off. But this idea that crests have to be embossed on the proper school uniform, it's very unreasonable in the current climate. And the survey out today by Bernarda's, Geraldine, I'm sure you've seen it, that 1 in 4 secondary school parents say they have to take out a loan or borrow from friends in order to meet back-to-school costs. Now, these back-to-school costs, the uniforms cannot be justified because a generic uniform is available to buy in most of our multiple stores at the moment. Also, the idea of if the government can give the free books to primary schools, they should be able to give it to secondary schools as well. We have the costs of bus transport, and then one I'm sure that's close to your heart that needs to be addressed. This whole idea of where, despite what grand schools get from the government, we have the so-called voluntary fees, which are not voluntary, by the way.
Yeah, I love your terminology of so-called voluntary fees, because they are not voluntary fees. Who has been disadvantaged, Clem? It's the disadvantaged who are being disadvantaged, further disadvantaged,
yes,
by the request from the school for a voluntary contribution. Those who can afford it don't bat an eyelid. They can pay it, you know, no issue, no problem. But it's the children of the parents who cannot afford it. And they feel, you know, are they being watched? Are they being compromised? It's unfair. Do my friends know it? It's not nice. So, if the capitation grants are adequate, why is any school asking for extra? Because it's not voluntary if they're requested to make it.
Yeah, it's sure. Sorry.
The generic uniform, as you said, and as I have alluded to there earlier, is the way to go. And let schools buy the crests and parents have the crests embossed by whatever manner or means. Right, if it's embroidery, whatever, hand sewn on, whatever, to the jumper, and that should reduce the cost. So normally, because they're available in the most of the outlet stores.
They are indeed. Now, the cost for a pupil in fourth class in primary school averaged €320, according to the Bernarda survey, with 424 last year. The cost for a first-year student, Geraldine, in secondary school is being put at €972 compared with 814 last year. I mean, Is that a figure that you can recognise, that it can cost up to €1,000 to send a child into first year in secondary school? Between books, voluntary contribution, everything else?
Well, the only way I can do the maths to come to an aggregate figure of 972 for that claim is that it must be the uniform, it must be the books, it must be the transport, and then it has to be this extra contribution.
Yeah, and on top of that, Geraldine, that's for one child. If
yes.
if you have, as most parents will have, more than one child, whether in the primary or secondary school, I know that there are certain government grants in this case, but the burden on students, whether you're receiving government subsidies or whether you're in what Leo Varadkar loves to call the squeezed middle class, is quite enormous and unacceptable, I'd say.
Well, it is unacceptable. If we're so-called public schools, why is education so expensive? Why is the cost so expensive for the parents? Because it's not the students, it's the bank of mum and dad who are paying for the cost of the students. And as you say, if they have more than one child, then it's compounded. So the parents are going without. It's been reported on numerous radio shows this year and last year, that parents are doing without to provide lunches for the children in the schools where lunches aren't available, and to meet the cost of the children going to school, whether it's uniforms, whether it's books, whether it's transport, or this extra contribution.
All right. In primary schools, we see 75% of children have a crested or branded uniform. 93% have a crested or branded uniform in secondary school. I think that all guff about the branded uniform needs to go. And once children have a generic uniform, you can sew on the crest, you can press it on or whatever else. Geraldine, one final question for you briefly. What's your mission statement for your presidency of the Association of Secondary Teachers in Ireland?
Well, my mission statement, Clem, would be my three priorities, and my mission statement would be the attractiveness of teaching that is fueling the teacher shortage, workload, and of teacher workload, and of course then to a senior cycle change to endeavour to address those issues.
All right. Well, congratulations on your election as President of the Association of Teachers in Ireland, of Secondary Teachers in Ireland, Geraldine O'Brien. I'm sure that we'll chat again during the year here on KFM.
Thank you, Clem.
And good morning.
Thank you for having me.
Not at all. Good morning to you.
Kildare Today with Clem Ryan.
With Whitewater Shopping Centre Newbridge, Ireland's largest regional shopping centre. Fashion, food, film, all under one roof in the heart of Newbridge. WhitewaterSC.ie.
Okay, tough times indeed for parents over the next couple of weeks or so, with all schools reopening in the last week of August in terms of those costs. They're quite staggering and such a burden on people, I have to say. Quite enormous, by the way. And speaking of burdens on people, I see that the Irish Nurses and Midwives Organisation says the 479 admitted patients are waiting for beds this morning. That's according to the INMO Trolley Watch. 329 patients are waiting in the emergency department, while 150 are in wards elsewhere in the hospital. I'll catch up on some of your messages in just a couple of minutes' time. But Caoimhe, you can tell us something about what menu you have for Kildare Focus this afternoon, between 2 and 3.
So we will be speaking to the a spokesperson from Google on the most Googled things in the country. Apparently, it's two of our favourite things, the weather and sport, Clem, but we'll get all the information from our lady later on this afternoon. Also, I will be speaking to a clinical psychologist and also the author of a book on why people cry, and we'll be finding out whether it's a good or a bad thing if you're a crier. And we'll also be speaking to a little girl who has been named as an ambassador for Down Syndrome Ireland, and she's a Kildare girl from the county.
All right.
Yeah, so we've a jam-packed show.
Not jam-packed, but between 2 and 3. Are you a crier? Are you a baller? Are you?
Day to day, no. But like I'd say, every now and again,
I might. Would you cry at a film, watching a film?
Ooh, depends on what it is. I might, yeah.
Would you cry at funerals?
If I knew the person. I always find it awkward if I didn't know the person too well to cry, just because I feel like if the family aren't crying, you know.
And do you bawl your head off at weddings?
I would tear up at a wedding, I might,
Okay. All right, I cry when Clare lose or Kildare, or when Kildare lose in regards to that. Now, before you go, Caoimhe Hearnaigh, researchers have identified 8 habits that could see people live more than 20 years longer. The study found that the lower physical activity, opiate use and smoking have the biggest impact on lifespan and were associated with around a 30 to 45% higher risk of death, while stress, binge drinking, poor diet and poor sleep hygiene were each associated with around a 20% increase in the risk of death. And the lack of positive social relationships was associated with a 5% increased risk of dying. So you want to avoid all of those things if you want to live longer. Meanwhile, a separate study suggests that incorporating olive oil into your diet could help reduce the risk of dying from dementia. It found that consuming more than half a tablespoon of olive oil per day is linked to a 28% lower risk of dying from the condition compared with those who never or rarely eat the oil. Olive oil. I hate olive oil.
Do you?
I do, yeah. The findings from both studies were presented at Nutrition 2023, which is the annual meeting of the American Society for Nutrition being held in Boston. What the research looked at lifestyle habits, Caoimhe.
Yeah, the lifestyle habits as well, Clem. Hold on now till I just...
There were 719,147 people were enrolled in various establishments, and the research found that men who have all 8 habits at age 40 would be predicted to live an average of 24 years longer than men with none of these habits. And for women, having all 8 healthy lifestyle factors in middle age was associated with a predicted 21 additional years of life compared to women with none of these habits. So a half tablespoon of oil a day, and you're to avoid stress, binge drinking, poor diet and poor sleep hygiene. And if you're a man, you will live 20 years longer. And if you're a woman, you live 21 years longer. That's what the research says anyway. Okay, we leave it there. Crime Time, we've pushed it into tomorrow because we ran out of a little bit of time. And don't forget, Caoimhe's back with Kildare Focus between 2 and 3 this afternoon. And both of us will be back here in the morning at 9 for another Kildare Today. Meanwhile, let's go to the newsroom. Have a great, great day. Oisín Cáin has the latest.